Yeah, I think I'm trying to think of a diplomatic answer to this question.
Okay, so it is as bad as I thought it was.
I do know some of the I do know some of the history of some of these experiments, but let's maybe go back to the A/B testing part.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello everyone again, welcome back to Design Huddle. Ryan is out again, so we're playing tag with Ryan at the moment. But we have a special guest today, Carl Salisbury. I can't read or spell, but at the moment he's working at Adyen. We're debating, I was trying to pronounce it before I said RDN, because again, I can't read. And works with like really big companies such as Uber, Wise, Spotify, eBay, Microsoft, and LinkedIn. So welcome.
No, that was good. Great. Thanks for having me.
So we posted a thing on LinkedIn, and then we were talking about dark patterns in the travel industry, or especially where it does feel like users are being tricked to sign up for things, and like the generic design industry is like, well, this is terrible. But as a UX designer who's worked in that industry, I mean, how do you responded on in LinkedIn quite a positive way, but I'm just curious, how would you respond to that again?
I think it depends what you mean by dark patterns. But for the most case, I agree. When I think what a lot of people are referring to when they think of dark patterns can be things like highlighting urgency. So when a property might have a limited amount of rooms on an online travel agent website like Booking.com or Expedia, and then there's a message that highlights that there's only a certain amount of rooms there. That's not necessarily always true, and it is
Oh,
stated
really?
usually, right, that well, it is stated on the website that that's how many rooms might be available on their website, but it doesn't mean that the property's released all of those rooms yet, or that they may not be available elsewhere. So I think there is more transparency around that now, but yeah, it definitely can feel like a pressure tactic for sure.
But I mean, are those things, does I mean, say like all the execs or the designer PM and engineers in a room together, it's okay, we've got a metric, like we need to push people to get through the process quicker. I mean, how do these, I mean, do these concepts just gradually evolve from there, or someone goes, okay, let's lie. I mean, obviously people are not saying, well, let's lie to the users. I mean, how do they actually, because this is like, you know, when someone's not in the room, they all these kind of like, oh, this people evil, like, all right, they're you know, how more, how can we trick them? But it's usually a lot more scattier than that, I find.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to think of a diplomatic answer to this question.
Okay, so it is as bad as I thought
I do know
it
some of the I do know some of the history of some of these experiments, but let's maybe go back to the A/B testing part. So everything that you would see, if we're talking about Booking.com specifically, majority of the things on that website are done vetted through A/B tests,
Yeah.
and then that is using metrics, which could sometimes be how many customers book. But then there could be other metrics like things like are they contacting customer service, and then any other sort of behavioral metrics you might be measuring there. And for those who aren't familiar with how A/B testing works, so you have like what we call a base, which is the existing website. And then you have a variant or variation. So you change something and you have a base, you split the traffic in half, and then you see how does one perform against the other. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that's more or less how it works.
Yeah.
So most of those sort of things have been evaluated through A/B tests, but it is only one data point. So there's also the qualitative research when you might go and talk to users and see how they feel about messages of urgency. I think it is a known problem, but then also that the experiments are also tied to business metrics as well. So there's that really is the challenge for most designers working in that space, or any company really that's very A/B testing driven, is that
Yeah.
it's can be very difficult to change things.
So what would you say the most important metric in the travel industry is then?
For travel,
Yeah.
or bookings? more or less. Yeah. For the business, I'd say bookings. Then if you're also thinking of like operational scalability, it's how many guests contact customer service. So generally, you don't really want, well, for lack of a better word, pissed off guests, because
yeah, of course.
It also means that your call centers can't handle all that inbound. So guest satisfaction is still very important.
Yeah.
But you know, more existentially, it's about the bookings, and then I'd say it's also around the contact with the guests with the online travel agents, but then also like contact between the guests and the properties. That's another thing that's of a concern too. So there's not too much back and forth thing between those things.
So like, say you have, I don't know if you did OKRs at booking.com or at the Flight Travel Center, or Flight Center Travel rather, but your team is told we need to increase bookings by X amount. What does that ideation look like for your team? Like, are you sitting in a room thinking, okay, what are the ways that can improve the existing booking experience versus adding things that increase the urgency?
So I think it depends on what you're working on, because there's a lot of different pieces that come together to form like a website like booking.com. And I can't speak so much for other online travel agents, but I'd say it's probably similar with Airbnb. Is you have, depends how the business is split up. So there might be teams that might need to optimize like a booking funnel, and that's more on the where the guest is looking to book. But then there's also teams that will be looking on the sourcing side of things. So can they get better prices from the properties, or also can they sort of reduce some of the operational load that the properties have as well? So it's quite granular. So just I think every team will have an objective that will be based on like how does their piece sort of fit in with this overall thing of, you know, generating bookings. So it's usually, I wouldn't say it's like every team is like, yeah, we need to increase bookings. They might be focused on a particular metric.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the actual user journey and flow, are you mapping out from start to finish, or can other folks from other orgs say, well, actually, in these bookings, we need to include these checkboxes or these radio buttons that upsell stuff? Because I think one of the other considered dark patterns, you know, so I think this is for all forms, marketing forms as well, like that checkboxes are automatically selected. Like in travel, it's like insurance is already selected. I mean, do you have much, as a designer, do you have much control in that space?
I think it depends on the topic and what it is you're working on. So I'd say, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase it from booking, but I'd say because everything is vetted through A/B tests, it can be challenging there to change things if that's the primary sort of thing that gatekeeps decisions.
Yeah.
I would say that designers do have capacity to change things, but they also need to prove that it's better.
Yeah.
And that's from an experience point of view, but also from a business point of view, is it gonna lose a lot of money for the business too, and will that affect, you know, how competitive it is with other online travel agents?
So it's hard to make the ethical argument if the existing A/B test result shows that by doing this, you've increased revenue by X amount, basically.
Well, the test could have also been run many years ago. It's hard to sort of, if you're trying to change it, then you're almost like, if you're introducing bad news, that's a classic problem with a lot of A/B tests, is if something introduces something to someone who's booking who's not aware of that, then most of the time that will mean that people will book less. So you really have to prove that it's better.
Yeah. For overall, I mean, what do you think about the A/B testing method in general? I mean, clearly something is working for booking.com, like, because they're very successful. But I've always seen that there's an over reliance on A/B testing that may not be fully accurate.
I actually agree. So I think A/B testing is generally a good thing. It brings a level of objectivity and like some scientific rigor to design. I think it removes a lot of biases that teams have in their decision making, which might be that the product manager maybe wants a certain feature, or maybe one person feels strongly about it, or there could be some bias in the qualitative research. So it does give you a concrete sort of picture on what the path forward might be, but I don't think it should be the only data point in decision making, because I think you also have these classic problems like false positives or false negatives, where what this might be is, if you think of like the medical example of A-B tests when you're running a clinical study, and then a false positive might be that a test says that someone is pregnant when they're clearly pregnant. So then you know that's a false positive. I hope that's the probably a good example, but that's where you need to sort of also use the common sense in saying, like, is this actually better? So looking at all the data points. And I think, to be fair, that is more the case at Booking, that there is more maturity there in looking at other data points. But then you also need to look at the business impact as well. So it's a challenging space for designers to work with A/B tests.
Yeah, I mean, were you doing a sort of qualitative research as well? Were you actually interviewing people? Because I suppose one of the challenges of these kind of flows is that it's hard to put a realistic thing in front of someone and observe them, because people are booking flights at a very specific time with a very specific urgency, or, like, you know, if it's a holiday or if it's like an emergency, or like there is always, it's always very tied to, like, you know, it's a very hard space to emulate the kind of, you know, because travel is one of the most stressful things, and obviously now since COVID it's probably even more stressful. So how do you actually can do that meaningfully? So, like, because the great thing about A/B test is you're actually observing people doing stuff in real time, but you don't necessarily know why. But, like, exactly. How do you get that from the more qualitative stuff?
No, that makes sense. So I will say, first of all, that at Booking they do quite a lot of qualitative research. Research is very much like part in the DNA of the company, and A/B testing is also a research method. It's just a different kind of research. It's tricky. So there's a lot of different trip types too that you might have noticed, right? So you could be traveling for leisure, maybe for business, but then could be other purposes, right? So you might need to travel to a funeral, for example, or maybe sick relative. So there's lots of different reasons why you would travel, and then there's different types of bookings that people make. So it might be a couple, or you could be on your own, but then you might also be in, like, a family or in a group, and that's, I think, where it gets a bit messy, because across most online travel agents, it's optimized very much for, like, singles and couples. That's like the main use case. And then I think the missed opportunity is more around groups and families and those other sort of trip types that I think haven't really been served so well, even business, actually.
How would you, if you were to have a magic wand and make it easy, I mean, what sort of things would you think are missing for, like, those sorts of experiences?
Just across different trip types?
Because I have kids, more family. Like, what do you think is missing that could make it easier, like, from the UI point of view or the experience?
I think just not just focusing on those primary use cases and thinking more about, okay, when you have a group coming to stay at a property, what does that look like? How does the property know how many people are actually trying to fit into that room? And similarly with, like, a family, you know, can that actually accommodate a family? I think that's where there needs to be a bit more structural change to how these like booking websites actually work, because they're very much optimized for where they get most of their bookings. I think less so for these different use cases.
And as you were speaking, a thing popped into my head, especially like the booking thing. Me and Ryan have spoken about this in the past, of like iconography and stuff. Like, you have a lot of, like, some of these places have a lot of information that need to convey, Wi-Fi, pet friendly, all that. I mean, what did you find was the most effective? I've always sat on the thing that if you're going to use iconography, you have to use labels, because you leave stuff down to interpretation. Often people make the wrong one. And that's the worst thing, is to end up at a hotel with a pet when it's, like, not pet friendly because you misunderstood an icon. I mean, how did you deal with that immense amount of information that has to be customizable as well, depending on location and or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think icons are quite problematic, right? Particularly when you look at different cultural interpretations. So you could have, maybe if you said there's like an icon for a chapel, but maybe you're in the Middle East, maybe that should be the moon and the star icon. Or similarly with, like, you know, maybe a piggy bank for money, but then a pig could also be offensive in other countries. So, like, that's where icons, like, they're not really that universal. So I think that's where you need the labels, right, to really describe, like, what the thing actually means. Some icons, I guess, get learned. I think you guys also mentioned, like, the Wi-Fi icon. A lot of people know what it means now because we've learned it. But Yeah, it depends. Is it drawing on like a metaphor from the real world, or did you just learn it somewhere? And depending on your cultural background, particularly if you're coming from different countries where maybe you didn't grow up with computers and your first experience was through a smartphone, and you're maybe not as exposed to icons, they might just have different interpretations. So I'd say they help. But with something like the booking.com website, everything's translated into a bunch of different languages. I'd say it's more reliant on copy than icons. The icons are just like there to help a little bit.
It's been my impression. So, I mean, because most, and we found that a majority of users scan read, they don't actually fully read. Mm. So how do you deal with that immense amount of information? I mean, there's a lot of UX, and also because a lot of this stuff is generated by the vendors themselves, presumably. Like, they're not necessarily, like, booking.com's not get hiring a UX writer for every single property, are they?
No, so the copy on the website is generated. The information is provided by the property. Some of it is vetted, some of it isn't. And this is a real challenge with a platform at that scale, because it is essentially a marketplace. So a lot of consumers will see it being more like going and booking with the property directly. In reality, it's more like buying something on eBay. So there's the booking.com is more of a middleman.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to, you have to vet. Not all the information is vetted. But to answer your question about the scannability, I don't know if I'm actually the best person to answer that, to be honest.
No, I'm just curious. Is like, you know, if like if you notice a difference between like bookings which had a lot of text versus a little. Because, I mean, some users really appreciate a lot of information, but I think most are trying to make a decision within a specific set time, right?
Yeah. That makes sense. Look, part of this is my opinion, but part of it's also things that I've observed. I'd say generally it depends on who's booking. So different information will be important to different people. As you mentioned before, like, you travel with your family, so there's things to you that would be important that might be different to me if I'm, say, just going to book a property by myself. I might just be primarily looking for a room. Maybe I'm not so worried about what are the facilities of the property. Yeah, you know, can kids be accommodated? So I think the information caters to different audiences. I'd say what seems to work is more is better, but I think that's just if you've got a platform that's catering to a lot of different people, then generally the more information converts. But I think that's just because you're dealing with such a volume of bookers.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think would be the most important thing to know about the travel industry as a designer?
That's a good question, actually. I mean, I've seen it from a few different sides. So the first was Flight Centre Group is, it's a very old company. So it's 40 years old, started by a guy who used to, fix up old school buses and take people on tours from London to Morocco. And then he started the company back in Australia and went from there, and then worked in the retail space. The reason I say that is it's actually a really old industry, and a lot of the systems that are in place that actually source the availability, so that's, the rooms that are available to sell and the way all these properties operate, it's been around for a long time. And I think it's been a bit of an awkward transition into the online space, where a lot of this stuff's become a lot more commodified, because back in the old days, you might have gone and booked at the property directly or called them up on the phone or looked in the Lonely Planet guidebook. But now it's a very different space. I think some properties are really adapted and really get it and offer things that are really beneficial to consumers, like Citizen M is amazing as a hotel chain. Yeah. And then there's a lot of other older ones that maybe haven't adapted as well, and some of them are getting phased out. So I'd say, that's what I'd say is like the thing to keep in mind with it is there's a lot of legacy technology there. And I'd say similar with flights too. I mean, the systems that flights work on, like, a lot of these go back to the 60s, and they just got all capitals text, like these global distribution systems that actually connect the flight booking websites to the the airlines.
Yeah.
So just a lot of the back end tech and the way these businesses operate is just really, really old school. So there's a lot of challenges there just on the operational side of things. I think
dealing with legacy tech and stuff.
Yeah, and I think just also just improving the efficiencies as well. It's just it's probably not as good as it could be. There's a lot of opportunity there to improve, like how the industry operates. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sort of seems to tie neatly into banking, which is also a huge legacy system. And as you're working at Adyen as a payment provider, would you see the similarities between that? Or, I mean, is Adyen very new?
We're not that new, actually. I think we're about 10 years old now. So we're a publicly listed company. So I think we went public a couple of years ago. Adyen is maybe similar in the sense that we're also a middleman. So we're a business that we handle payments for lots of different companies. When I say we do payments for some of these big brands, we don't necessarily even render the UI in the browser. We might even just be doing it through an API.
Yeah.
So like actually the movement of money is really messy, particularly when you're dealing with different currencies, different local payment methods. So if you look at, for example, the way banks are set up, and, you know, if you need to do what's called acquiring, so actually taking the money, that can be really difficult and also expensive to do as a business because you need to have relationships with all these different banks. So being a middleman in that sense helps when you can kind of connect these different companies to the money and allow it to flow.
Yeah.
So I think that's where, the banks, I think, haven't really done a good job of that. So that's where a lot of these payment processors like Adyen and Stripe have come in and really filled that niche in the market where it's just been really hard to get money from point A to point B. So there's a lot to be done in that space.
I find that these payment companies remind me a bit like the difference between, say, Uber and the huge taxi companies that used to just service businesses. That Uber came out of nowhere and a lot of these companies went bust because they made it really hard like to create the great service design and UX experience, where these companies like Adyen that you work for just make it so easy, like because it's solving a really complicated problem. And you know, companies like I suppose Wise and Spotify, they just want money to go through. I mean, they don't want to have to have a whole department dealing with that. So as a designer, where you're dealing with things where it's almost like on the API level working with that must be quite interesting because a lot of it is not UI, it's a UX that's engineered by the developers. So where do you feel you fit in that as a designer?
I think I'm still trying to figure that out myself. But it's been an interesting topic. So I work on documentation, which is also designing the content management system that powers the docs. So they're all generated by like Markdown and YAML files. But then it's also, I think it's a UX problem like anything you might work on. If you go and it's like developers are users, they're people like anyone else. And I think, you know, Stripe's done an amazing job of like really being the gold standard in developer experience. We see that it's if you look at their site, it's for developers, but it's more almost looks more like a consumer site, right? With their documentation. That's sort of what I'm also aspiring to do with Docs at Adyen is really just treat developers like any user you might have. So they do like beautiful UI UX. You know, usability is really important, and they fall into pain points much like anyone does. So that could be reading the documentation, but also looking at the API reference. Then they could also just be like just considering talking to some of the developer advocates who go and build example integrations or just sort of find ways to remove some of these pain points that developers fall into when they're trying to integrate with our platform. So I think it's an interesting space. I don't think it's been explored as much in the past, like thinking of developers as like an audience and bringing more like consumer grade UX to that space.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of been, developers don't always think about like, how do they namespace their variables and how are the APIs designed and how is that perceived by someone externally, right? So there's very niche problems that maybe haven't been thought of so much.
But as a designer, I mean, I've worked on Google.dev. I helped launch that, which was like basically a documentation site for for Android and whatever. But the thing which was always the biggest struggle with those kind of projects is they're not the most sexiest things to work on. You know, it's like, because it's not like this, amazing app. So, I mean, but it's such an important problem to solve because it's like designing the information in a way that's accessible, because that's really hard when there's a lot of stuff that's there. And how do the developer's mental model of when they're looking for stuff, like even like if you look at, say, the material design website, in the first iteration, was very hard to navigate because even they didn't know what the mental model could be. And so it's like over time it's evolved and become much better. How do you deal with like having to deal with these complex problems which are quite dry? I don't want to use the word boring. But and still remain inspired?
That's a good question, actually. I think for me it's quite a broad problem to solve. And I usually just approach it like I would anything. I mean, I've worked on consumer facing stuff, I've worked on like B2B stuff, and now I'm sort of working on this niche thing around developers. I don't know if it's necessarily what I'll be working on for the rest of my career, but it's definitely one of the more challenging problems that I've worked on. I think for me, that's what drives me a lot, is like just how complex is the problem to solve, and then what's the impact of solving it. So that sort of keeps me inspired. But I think also just looking at there are some great examples of developer portals that just look amazing, right? Like you look at some of the Tailwind stuff, and
they
just look really nice, and you can actually do some quite beautiful UI, even catering towards developers. I mean, at the moment, I'm completely overhauling the Adyen's docs, so you can get a bit of freedom there in creating like quite a beautiful and intuitive experience. And then also the problems are also very, very challenging. So I think it does help you to really sharpen your skills as a designer, because there's just a lot of complexity to work with. Whereas I think on the consumer side, often you're just removing a lot of pain points, not necessarily doing something from scratch.
So, I mean, just coming up to like the final questions, I mean, in terms of researching and working with the developers, I mean, what sort of activity, I mean, do you talk to the developer community? Because they're your users, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go about, how does that conversation, because, I mean, doing like a card sorting exercise just to figure out what the information hierarchy can be for something that complex would be quite hard in itself. Because, you know, you have different types of developers who come from like traditional web developers, a back-end developer who knows a bit of web but doesn't and is trying to think in, you know, how do you even start something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm sure you've tackled with this a bit yourself, but the approach that I take is similar to any B2B UX. Like I was doing at Booking when I was working on like pricing tools that were, you know, exclusively catered towards, you know, people like revenue managers or say property managers, that sort of thing. I think with developers, it's a similar sort of approach. I mean, I have a lot of interviews with merchant developers, basically talking to them about, you know, what's their experience been like using the documentation, what's their experience been like using our APIs, what are the problems that they fall into, but also the feedback loops around having feedback components within the docs themselves, feedback that you get from their account managers as well. And then there's also the developer advocates who sometimes talk to the developers. And we have like our Twitter at Adyen Devs as well, where we get feedback on there. So
yeah,
a lot of different inputs really. But yeah, I mean, it's similar to like consumer or B2B UX. You can also map out the journeys and understand where are the problems that people are falling into, where can you remove some of that friction. So I think for me, the approach is more or less the same. I think just the audience is more niche and the problems are more complex.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to finish off, like, where do you see product design in the next 5 years? And where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? Or is that like, wait, tech changes so quickly that, and they're completely two different questions, but.
That's a good question. I think it's interesting that you mentioned product design, because I was just thinking about job titles the other day, and I've held like a few of them. So I started off as a UX designer, and then I went to work as a UX architect, then I worked as a UX designer, and now I'm a product designer. So I don't know for how much longer I'll be called a product designer. So I'm guessing the job title might change again.
Yeah.
But what I think is really interesting is I've seen a bit of a convergence of, like, I suppose, like, traditionally what people would call UX and UI, and that there seems to be more of an expectation that designers can produce more polished deliverables, which I think is generally a good thing when you focus a bit more on the, not just the execution, but, like, the quality of that is just as important as the design process.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. I do think we're probably going to see it expand more into these niche spaces, like for developers, and then also maybe audiences that we haven't seen catered to as much before, like in enterprise tooling. There's so much like disruption that can happen there. If you look at Slack, for example, you know, a lot of enterprise chat tools weren't great, and then Slack brought in something that was more consumer grade. So I think bringing in that approach to these maybe underserved audiences, there's big opportunities and interesting problems to solve too for designers.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm just thinking that the number of chat apps I've used throughout my years has probably changed as much as my job title has. But yeah, no, thank you. I mean, I've always wondered about the product design, UX design thing. I mean, it sounds like product designer is the more fashionable thing, and UX designer is on the way out. But and I think there's some people with some really strong opinions of what the difference is between them. I've been asked by recruiters, like, would you like to be a UX designer? It's just basically a marketing web designer job. So it's I don't know if these titles really mean anything. So I guess about the responsibility. But yeah, no, thank you so much for like joining us. It was really, really appreciated your insight. Me and Ryan tried to cobble our views based on our limited experience on these specific things, but it's really great to hear. And it's interesting to hear how for a designer it can be quite challenging to do what you think is right, but then there's always business needs because we have to, you know, there's always, you know, you always have to make money. But yeah, thank you so much. If folks haven't subscribed, please do to the podcast. We also are segmenting our podcast into videos. Checking on the YouTube channel, it's quite small, but it's like it's picking up an audience. So please do join that as well. And thank you so much.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Design Huddle. The opinions expressed are solely our own and do not express the views or opinions of our employer.